Good.
Gee, all right. Welcome back to the Mystical Positivist. Our guest this afternoon is Danielle Taranio Roshi, Zen lineage holder in Robert Aitken's Diamond Sangha tradition and founder of Rocks and Clouds Zendo in beautiful downtown Sebastopol, California. Let's resume our discussion as your work in the Buddha Dharma. So before the break, we were talking about your involvement in the Fourth Way tradition and particularly the work with the Nylon group in Occidental. And after you left that group, you were describing how you reread some of the Buddhist books you had, and you found that you were being drawn towards the Buddhist tradition. And I'm before you tell us about what actual groups you got into, what was it that was you were finding in that material that was answering a need that had stopped being answered in the Fourth Way practices that you had been doing?
You know, literally what happened one day, I picked up a book in a bookstore. I didn't buy it. I read it in the bookstore, and I've never been able to find it again, by a well-known Austrian noble guy, Gottfried Prudrum, something. He's written a few books.
I think I know the guy you're talking about, but the exact name is eluding me.
He's written quite a few books, but he had a chapter in this book, and that's how whenever I see one of his books, I look for a chapter that is called, maybe I made this all up, you know, but I don't think so. The name of the chapter, I mean, I might have made it up, but it's called The Fallacy of Objectivity. And it was so incredibly clear what my problem was in what my problem became in the Gurdjieff work. And this had nothing to do with Mr. Nylon or Gurdjieff, I think, necessarily, but had to do with just my own idiosyncrasy. This pursuit of objectivity, and by pursuit, the pursuance of objectivity meant the negation of this, what I said before the break, you know, the negation of this, because this was subjective. By definition, this is subjective. So the objectivity was always some other place other than here. And in Zen was exactly the opposite. It is always here. And if it's not here, it's not nowhere.
Interesting. You know? It's interesting in that certainly the rap that the traditional Gurdjieff work has is a very idea-filled cosmological scheme, which is almost in a separate category from the very strong emphasis on practical work. And Gurdjieff was certainly someone who is very much in the world and very much grounded in the world. But this sense that we're trying, you know, the sense, I guess, in the Fourth Way or the interpretation of the Fourth Way that we're trying to get away from something, trying to get away from our bad condition here as opposed to come closer to what it is that we're doing here is an interesting distinction.
Right.
So you found in the Buddhist material that it was drawing you forward.
Yeah. And it was, it's sort of a cliche, but it's a returning home. And it's very interesting working with John, because he recognized that, and as I said, he really supported the work that I had done and encouraged me that I was not a newbie, you know, I wasn't a rookie, and that, you know, I had done a lot of work and, you know, to take responsibility, if you will, for it.
So was John Terrence's group the group that you first came into when you moved towards Buddhism?
Yeah, it was called California Diamond Sangha then.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And was the practice of Zazen the central practice for the California Diamond Sangha?
Yeah.
So what was it about Zazen? I mean, I assume that Zazen, you found something important and useful in it.
Yeah.
Can you describe that?
The first day I went and I just sat. John was there and I didn't think that he was a teacher. There was another older man close to him, and I thought that must be the teacher. And in fact, John, somebody asked, I went with a friend that asked the question, And I didn't particularly like the way, I don't think John understood the question. And, you know, and I know, I knew this guy well, you know, we had talked about this issue. So it wasn't, at first, it wasn't like, oh, I really found the right person.
Mm-hmm.
But the sitting there and the talk afterwards and the chanting, especially of the Heart Sutra, in English, something felt like I'm home. Although that's not the way I called it then. You know, I called it like that maybe a few months later. But I felt, and that week, they used to meet on Mondays, and that week, between that Monday and my second Monday, there was a quality in that week that had completely, something had changed, you know. I don't think there was nothing magical, except that I just found something that rung a bell, if you will, you know. Right. And you know, I never left.
So I'm interested when you first were interviewing with Tarrant Roshi and talking about your background in the fourth way. What was it that was, what do you see now as the preparation that you had, or what was the work that you had done that became a useful foundation for your deepening into the Zen path?
You know, one thing I'm really grateful about the Gurdjieff work is the emphasis in physical work. You know, right now I am a woodworker. I'm still a woodworker, and I teach quite a bit. And there's no way that I would leave my shop, you know, because it keeps me in a certain balance. And if all I did was teach, I think I'd be a wreck more than what I am, if I am one, you know. And that's something that I remember when I first started painting houses in the city. I was going to school. No, I had quit. I'd quit the university for a while and started painting houses. It felt like I had really, finally made it. I'm just, you know, I'm a blue collar worker, you know, and that's where it was at. You know, it's sort of goofy, but that's the way it felt. And I grew up exactly the opposite. No, I mean, we had servants up the wazoo for everything.
It's funny for me to hear you say that, because as I first began my work with Taiyu Meditation Center when I moved up to Sonoma County, I had left a graduate physics program, and I had a undergraduate degree in physics, and had conceived that my life was going to be this trajectory into academia. And the first job I had was painting houses, and it was with a house painter. And
who was another Taiyu practitioner.
Yeah, who was a Taiyu practitioner, and it was striking how ill-equipped I was for that kind of work, and I came to appreciate the level of attention and the level of actual artistry in simply doing a labor like that with an economy of expression or an efficiency of motion, which I was so far away from. And it was just that. It was like a completely different way of working, and yet it was such a rich resource.
Yeah, and in the group there were a lot of, the print shop here was run by this man that had a PhD in physics. The wood shop was run by a man that had a PhD in physiological psychology. You know, so everybody had PhDs. I didn't, you know, I was much younger, you know, than them, but you know, I was still in my undergraduate work. But yeah, it felt so that emphasis in physical work, that sometimes, Zen has it, you know, but more and more I think it's going out away from it. There's so much academia in the Zen world, or psychology, as we were talking, psychologists, you know, and lawyers and stuff. You know, there's nothing wrong with none of them, but it's...
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, when I met my teacher, I was an apprentice in a lithography apprenticeship program. It's actually at the time the state of California had, you know, administered that sort of thing. And I made my living throughout all my early training, and then for years later doing lithography, a very blue collar sort of thing. And then later I went out and got a PhD because that was something that I was interested in doing in this particular area of archaeology. But archaeology, of course, if you're going to get a PhD, you can hardly be more literally in the dirt than right. that one, right. than that arena. But there is, it is very important for sure, in my view, to engage all, to use the Gurdjieffian terms, to use all the centers, and not just to be, allow the in our culture, the natural dominance of the mind to continue to hold sway. So, well, that brings me then to another question. I mean, I know that as we were coming here to the studio today, you talked about doing sessions in South America, which Stuart mentioned in his biographical sketch of your life and work. And this, it seems to me that sesshin is a technique that allows people to get out of the usual space that their head is in when they're in the midst of daily life. I wonder if you could talk more about that yeah. aspect of Zen practice.
And describe what's meant by that term and what's meant by
thank you.
Zazen, since right. I think many of our listeners may not right. be familiar with those terms.
Right. Zazen literally means seated meditation. Zen being the Japanese word for the pronunciation of the Chinese word chan is Zen, and the Chinese word chan is the Chinese pronunciation of the word jhana, which is in Sanskrit, the meditation, and za is seated. Sesshin literally means to touch shin, to touch the heart-mind, to encounter the heart-mind, to meet it. So, sesshin, what it is, it's basically about, in our lineage, is about 12 hours or so of meditation. We get up at 5. We used to get up at 4. Now we do it at 5.
shocking decline of standards.
Yeah. We get up at 5, and we go to bed around 9:30, 10. And we have periods of meditation interspaced with walking meditation, sitting meditation for, in our case, 25 minutes, and then 5 minutes of walking meditation. And the day is all like that. And we have breaks for breakfast and lunch and dinner. And in between, we have 4 blocks of meditation.
Is it a silent period?
Silent. Everything is silent. The only thing it's not silent is the private interviews with the teacher. And if you're working in the kitchen, maybe you need to hear instructions of how to chop the vegetables or something. And you might have a question, you know. Ideally, people don't talk. with breaks for work and rest. And our meals are usually eaten in a sort of a formal way called oriyoki, which literally means just enough. And it's with 3 bowls, and, you know, there's a little ceremony that we do some chanting while we eat. Not while we eat, but interspaced with our eating. And we do some offerings of grain and then of tea. There's a talk called Teisho. And then there's Doksan, which is the private interviews. So every day you have Doksan once or twice a day. Japanese teachers have 4 times a day because their interviews are like 1 minute, you know. You haven't finished your prostration when the guy's ringing his bell. Thank you very much. Get out of here. So, yeah, that's what... And, you know, it's a time completely dedicated to do nothing but your practice. So you don't have to make any kind of decision. Everything is decided for you. I mean, you don't decide, I'm taking a break now, or, you know. You eat when we all eat. We rest when everybody rests. You can certainly take a walk instead of resting, or go running or whatever. And just concentrate on your practice. And whether you're working on a koan, whether you're working on just sitting, or your breath, you just completely dedicate your energy to this one thing. Which reminded me of what you were talking earlier about the question of the centrum of gravity that you were calling it. And so if you're working with the koan mu, which is a very well-known koan, and a lot of the people start with that koan, that's all you do all day. You sit and with mu, become one with mu over and over again. Thoughts, feelings arise, opinions, judgment, you notice, and come back to mu. And that's, you know, that's it. Or whichever other koan you might be working, and or not a koan, or just the fact that your body is there in a certain posture. The posture, we're not very strict with the posture, as long as you're somewhat comfortable. You can sit in a chair, you can sit on a bench, you know, can sit, doesn't matter how you sit. But we try not to move much.
So would you, are you, am I understanding you to say that as one is engaged in Zazen, that one might also work with the koan?
Absolutely.
So, again, for our listeners not familiar with the term, since koan has actually seeped its way into the common vernacular, but maybe you could give us a more precise description of what a koan practice amounts to.
Right. Literally, it means a public case, like in the legal tradition. I always find that not very helpful. They usually, sometimes in this case of mu is just a word. The koan mu goes, a monk asks the teacher Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou responds, mu, which literally means does not, or no, or not. It's negative. And that's it. Of course, we know that all beings by nature are Buddha, you know, and the monk, of course, must know this because they recite it every day. So something else is going on here. And so you're left with that. And there you spend the next few months, years, or lifetime with it. Yeah, then there are all sorts of koans. Some of them are stories, regular stories. Could be half a page long, or maybe even a full page. No, not a full page, but of a dialogue of questions and answers, and strange dialogue sometimes. Sometimes not very strange, seems like just an ordinary. Where do you come from? Oh, from up the mountain. What do you do? Oh, I was chopping wood. Did you go to the top of the mountain? Oh, I haven't. No, I never made it to the top. Then you don't know mountains. Something that could be something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So you get to, but usually, when we work with koan, there's usually at the beginning koan that it's going to be the breaking point, you know. And that's the one that you tend to stay longer. You know, and as I say, people can spend a year, 6 months, or some people can spend a week, or 2 days in the first koan. It's unusual, but that can happen. And then in our lineage, then comes a bunch of other ones. And in our tradition, it's rather methodical. So there are various texts that we go through. One, you know, one of 48 cases, the other one of 100 cases, then another one of 100 cases. And in between, at the beginning, there's a whole bunch of so-called miscellaneous. So I'm not sure how many koans, if you so-called finish the training, you might go through, I really don't know, but 400, 600 or so. Mm-hmm.
And when someone goes through a koan, is there a shift that you as a teacher are looking for in the student, or is a koan something one becomes familiar with and sort of like we were describing with the centrum of gravity question will continue to be a resource that one can mine throughout one's practice?
Both things, I think. In a way, both things. Edgar Roshi used to say that his home base is the koan mu. That's where he resides, if you will, or keeps coming back to just mu. If I would have to choose one, if this one for me, it would be, what is it? You know, just that. But you see, it probably means nothing to anybody else in a certain way, you know. Although in the Zen tradition, what is it? It is an important question. What is it? So in my case, I just, whatever I'm doing, sometimes that question just, I just, hey, what is it? Oh, I'm so happy. I'm tired. What is it? You know, it's a little bit, I call it like a slap in the face, you know, just enough of like a something foreign, you know, although I'm familiar with it, but it's enough of like makes me look again, you know. And you know, you're just cruising, you're just doing your ordinary mechanical kind of blah blah blah, doing a thing, and then stop, like the stop exercise that Mr. G would do, you know.
I'm interested, since we're talking a little bit about the practices directly, how you compare both this koan practice, particularly what is it, zazen, and the practice of self-observation as described in the Fourth Way work. Because in this program, in previous shows, we've actually had speakers who have gone into great detail about self-observation. So I'm interested to see how, if there's a distinction, if they achieve similar things, or if you see the emphasis as being quite different.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Nyland didn't use that term much at all, self-observation. He just called it work on yourself, and that implied. he used this, maybe you've heard through some other people that were members of the group. He used the term of creating an I, and he called it a little I, just to make us know that we created from as a will, as an energy, you know, as an aspiration, as a wish. He loved the word wish, the concept of wish, the wish in your heart to wake up. That creates this little I, he would call it. And then he'd say, little I, shmai, it's like nothing. You know, it's just a little tool that we play with. But the idea, really, was a certain kind of meditation in movement. When doing our physical work, repetitive physical work, if you pay enough attention to that repetitiveness as you put the shovel on the ground and push it with your foot, and then put the dirt on your left side or your right side, and you do that over and over again. If you can have something in the moment and impartial, observing that, and that would be the capacity of this little eye that you would create, something objective, impartial and simultaneous with the actual movement, that could record, if you will, that, you know, or something, some kind of like awareness of it in the moment, never describing it, but just in the moment. So that, if I can relate it to meditation, it's like meditation in movement meditation, you know. Because in meditation, we don't want my opinion. I don't want my opinion. I mean, it arises and it insists in manifesting, and my like and my dislike and my rejection and my grabbing and rejecting. That's part of the conditioning of our habitual patterns, you know. But that is not what I did, I come back to the method of what, or the breath or the koan, that will leave the mechanism of the I reinventing itself or reconfirming itself, and you just come back to the method, you know. You don't worry about controlling that mechanism, but you just come back to the breath. If you're counting as 1, 2, the exhalation, or it's mo, you know, or it's just the sensation in the body, or it's just listening to the dog barking, just wah wah, wah. And that, and the building of that, the building of that, that's, you know, the term, we cultivate attention in that form, you know, not going with our habitual patterns, falling into habitual patterns of behavior, but coming back to the immediate reality, if you will, of the moment. And if you're working with breath counting, you come back to 1, 2, 3, so on. Am I being clear?
Yes, you're being very clear.
So sometimes you do experience things in the moment, you know, simultaneous with the actual, wow, 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 you know, it's just that. The whole universe is nothing but that barking, you know, or, you know, your breath and the pain in the knee and the bird singing. Sometimes you experience that, and there's no judgment, there's no evaluation, there's just that. There's just that. And in that sense, it's similar to this work on oneself that we would do in our physical task with Mr. Nyland's group.
Yeah, it's a distinction I see as you're describing it, which is interesting, is that whereas in the framework that you described with Nyland's group, there's an act of will to build something. What you're describing in the Zen practice is, if there's an act of will, it's simply to return back to.
Right.
And you don't concern yourself with the building of something as much as you concern yourself with returning attention back to an original position.
Right. Because what the Buddha discovered is that we, you know, it's our true nature that is this Buddha nature, you know. So there's nothing added. We do not have to build anything. We have to build maybe the capacity not to rely on this thing that we call self, that is separate from everything else, and it's always fighting the so-called outside to manipulate it, to get it to do what you want it to do. So in a way, this return—it's returning to some kind of elementality of life itself, you know. And that's the Buddhist view, you know. So you don't—you let the mind do its thing. It's like Suzuki Roshi gave speaking of cows, you know, gave the image of if. And in Zen, you know, the image of the bull or the ox, as the mind, is very much present. So you give the ox enough room to do its oxiness, you know. If you keep it enclosed in small quarters, the ox is going to try and mess with the fence. So you let the mind do what it does. As Aitken says, you know, it secretes thoughts as the stomach secretes digestive juices. So you don't fight that. You let it do what it does. But at the same time, something comes back to the method. Something comes back to the breath. So the breath is always happening independent of your reactions or thoughts or feelings. So if you can just reside, if you will, with the breath, become one with the breath, the mind can do its thing. So, of course, the mind quiets down a little bit, but the point is not to actively quiet the mind, mm-hmm. but just to remain present in the posture, in the breath, you know, with the sound of the moment that might arise. That's another way of coming back.
So this is in Zazen you're mostly describing, but is it also not in daily life as well?
Sure. You see, but as we started talking about Sesshin, so in Sesshin, you see, you devote all your energy. You know, you still fantasize as hell and
of course
do everything you do anywhere else, you know. But it's a little bit more restricted. You get bored. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing to do. You're just sitting facing a wall.
Right.
So the first few days of Sesshin, classically, they're very difficult. Not the first hours, you know, you're excited, but then comes boredom, comes tiredness, and the resistance. What the hell am I doing here? I shouldn't be here. I think if I feel like this tomorrow, I'm just going to take off. And, you know, all this resistance. And after a while, you know, you keep on coming back, you keep on settling down, and then the resistance stops. And as we know, you know, what resists persists, you know. So in a way, it's really a process of getting more and more familiar, becoming more and more intimate with this thing.
That makes sense. Well, but the other thing, there's another aspect to this that I find interesting, which is that, for example, I was talking last week to this Burmese Buddhist teacher, Dr. Yeah. Tintin. And she was telling me how she laughed. I asked her a question, and she laughed, and she said, "Oh, the teaching Burmese students mindfulness is so different than teaching American students mindfulness." And I don't know if your students in Argentina or Chile are that much different than Californians, but I'm wondering. Number one, so this is a several part thing I want to explore with you, if you've noticed different cultural differences there, in some ways. Number two, the other thing is that Zen, of course, as you yourself pointed out, it comes from India, went to China, became Chan, went to Japan, became Zen. Now it's come to America. You yourself had a it came from Japan through an American who taught Aiken Roshi, who taught
an Australian
Tarrant Roshi, who's now teaching a Chilean-born American. Right. You, and this Zen that we know has, at least to the American mind, has this association with a whole set of Japanese cultural practices, aesthetics, you know, a certain kind of aesthetic and stuff like that. So this is really a series of questions I'm asking you about. But yes, it is just this. How could it be anything other than this? But this is rooted in different cultural places, right, in different cultural moments. So yeah. Talk about that that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is definitely different cultures. South America, it is a different place, you know, although it's getting more and more Americanized. I mean, the whole world is getting more and more Americanized.
Well, just to be fair, I think of it more as becoming this sort of consumer world.
Yeah.
America may have been the first, but it seems to be something, a life unto itself.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely, you're right. You know, I remember when Eiken Roshi went to Argentina and made some comments of cultural differences, and I, years later, having my own experience going there and teaching, and in Chile too, people are less. In a certain way, we here in America, in the United States of America, we're a little bit greedier. Greedier in the sense of attainment, you know? For example, people, when you do koan work, one of the dark sides of koan work, a certain kind of dark side, is that sometimes people get greedy. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they want to, quote, pass the koan and get another one and pass that other one and maybe get into the next text. And then maybe even if you happen to know or suspect that your companion, you know, over there, you know, is in that text and you think that, God, you don't like him too much. How can he be in that text? And, you know, all the typical things, you know, sort of childish. But so, and in really, in Argentina and in Chile, there's not much of that. You know, people really finish a koan, and they said, oh, I'd like to stay with this for a while. Don't give me the next one yet.
I'm thinking of the...
And it's completely, that has never... I tell people, why don't you stay with this, even though you so-called passed it, stay with this another week or another 2 weeks.
I'm thinking of the metaphor of all the video games that kids play now, where you go to each level, there's a new level, and there's a new level, and there's a new level, so everyone's conditioned to move forward.
There's a man in Buenos Aires who will without a doubt, will start teaching at some point in the next few years. Mm-hmm. He's been ready, I think. Here, somebody like that would really be antsy.
Chomping at the bit. Huh?
Right. And it's hard because you're not supposed to be very, very actively pursuing that, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's like, but this guy, you know, he says, I'm not ready. And we're never ready. You know? So I think it's a big problem when somebody thinks that they're ready, you know. I mean, I was certainly not ready.
Yeah, I totally resonate with this. You know, my teacher had the view that he wanted to, you know, kick people in the butt and get them moving, and that was really good for me.
Sure.
But it also meant that I was supposedly ready when I didn't feel ready at all. It took me many years of practice after I was so-called ready to be able effectively to teach in any way whatsoever from my perspective now and at the time, but it was also extremely good for me to get that pachamtuchus, to get that push.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also nice to appreciate when a person is doesn't have to identify with that compulsive need to kick himself in the butt to move forward.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think. It's different when someone else is doing it to you as opposed to you're compulsively doing it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, and that usually is so it's so self-concern and self-preoccupation, and it's all full of that.
Yeah.
Me.
Right.
And America has a rich tradition of self-appointed preachers.
Yeah.
The whole history is filled with people on their soapbox, and in the Christian tradition, you know, it doesn't take much for someone to be a hellfire minister.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it is an interesting aspect of this culture that, you know, it's very attainment oriented.
Yeah. Our friend Lee Lazarick, who just died a few months ago, was a huge advocate of the position that he would maintain that people were getting promoted too fast in a variety of different traditions before their practice had settled to a point where it was mature enough to withstand the tests that someone who's in that kind of position of responsibility needs to be able to withstand. And Halfway Up the Mountain was the name of a book that one of his students wrote, Mariana Kaplan, which describes the position that that people like that find themselves in. And Halfway Up the Mountain is when you think you're at the top of the mountain, but you're really only halfway. That's a dangerous position, really. Actually.
Yeah. I completely agree, you know. It's like it took me quite a few years to believe that, you know. At first my few years of teaching was like, don't pay any attention to it. It's just a word. You're just the same person. I still have my friends, which are all my Dharma brothers, but now I'm supposedly a teacher. But it's just a word. It's just a word. And I did not want to take it seriously. I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while. It took me a while. And John pushed me a bit, you know. I mean, he says, Daniel, you are the teacher.
I'll just say that I've noticed the change myself, because we invited you to speak at Many Rivers a year or two after we opened, I think, and you were reluctant. I remember.
Oh, I used to run away from you guys.
Yeah, I can know that.
Every time you would invite me, I would. I mean, hopefully. Oh, I'm glad I'm going to Ohio. I don't have to talk to you.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah, and actually. Nowadays, I most of the time enjoy it, you know, which is good.
Yes,
I mean it's good because enjoy it because there's some aliveness, you know, that comes up.
Yes,
that it's real, you know. And,
absolutely.
And, yeah.
Well, there's a certain passion, and this is an interesting thing about the Buddha Dharma. It's like there are certain traditions within the overall Buddha Dharma that that emphasize the kind of extinguishing of passion that you find in some of the, like, the Theravada side of things, and for example, even in the Zen aesthetic, at least as Americans appreciate it, there's a kind of a belief that there isn't room for the kind of gutsy passion necessarily. That
sometimes there's that, but you know, I understand that, but mm-hmm. I really. That's not the way I identify. You know, this old teacher, Zhao Zhou, which I mentioned before, the Koan Mu,
mm-hmm.
he started teaching when he was 80. And he lived till he was 120. And this supposedly is true. It's not mm-hmm. just myth. It's mm-hmm. historically more or less proven. But once somebody asked him, the passions, how does one get rid of it? And he says, why do you want to get rid of them?
Good for him.
You know, it's, I think that real Buddhism. I mean, we don't use the word tantra much in Zen, but tantra. The little bit I somewhat understand, or the way that I interpret that, is what's the term that in medieval European culture, the transmutation of gold into
alchemy.
Alchemy. I think tantra is nothing but alchemy, and alchemy is no other than the spiritual transformation, you know, or it's an awakening. And do we awake because we're pure and perfect? We awake because we are who we are, you know.
We're led going into gold, right. if that's
right.
what we're doing.
Yeah, right, you know, and without impure, you know, as Aiken Roshi again says, in pure water, fish cannot live.
Right.
And purity, you know, if a student is preoccupied with purity, that's a red light immediately for me, you know, because, I mean, I understand that, the wish that one sometimes can have, especially if one is somewhat new. But it's also the insistence on purity, it's counterproductive, I think, to a healthy spiritual quest.
Hear, hear.
Very much so. I mean, I think of the tantric understanding, or my understanding of tantra from an outsider, is that it is, in the words of Arnaud Desjardins, who's a great non-dual teacher in France, is it's saying yes to life. Mm-hmm. So when things come at you, we embrace them. We open ourselves to them. We relax or surrender to them rather than fight them or try to control them or to push them away. That doesn't mean that Tantra is going out and having all the sex you can possibly have, but it does mean that when you are in a situation and that there may be elements of the, you know, pleasures of the body, one can engage in that with attention and loving kindness and presence to what's happening, and not have to have a particular set of rules that are guiding you. Mm. But getting to that place is a result of a long-term practice.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's I'm very not familiar with that. I mean, I'm familiar with the everyday conversation about tantra, you know, and the transformation of sexual energy, but I like the word tantra more in the general idea of just transforming what, you know, one's so-called imperfections, you know, one's so-called deep character quirks, you know. That can be, that energy can be used to wake up again and again, you know. Yeah.
Well, we have come to the end of our time.
All right.
It always goes by faster, and we don't get to talk about as many things as we'd like. So we'll have to encourage you to come back to this studio again sometime in the future, because this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Surprising conversation. I didn't know what we were going to be talking about.
Excellent.
I'm pleasantly surprised.
Well, thank you for joining us today on The Mystical Positivist.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thank
you. All right. That's all the time we have today for The Mystical Positivist. Next week, on April 16th, our guest will be Timothy Conway. Timothy Conway, PhD, spiritual teacher, author, and educator, living with his wife in Santa Barbara, California, has for over 30 years facilitated radical spiritual awakening. He has studied and practiced the non-dual essence of our sacred traditions for nearly 40 years, meeting enlightened masters in many traditions along the way. His books include Women of Power and Grace, 9 Astonishing, Inspiring Luminaries of Our Time, the forthcoming 2-volume India's Sages on Non-Dual Devotion and Wisdom, and a trilogy of books on spirituality in the new millennium. So I hope you can join us. On the spiritual calendar for this week in Sonoma County, Our own Rob Schmidt will be speaking at Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol this Thursday, April 14th at 7:30 p.m. on the topic, The Archaeology of the Self. Archaeologists make inferences about the lives of people in the past by examining the material remains produced by their behaviors. In the same way, the spiritual seeker makes inferences about invisible aspects of the makeup of the self through examination of the contents of consciousness of the body, mind, and heart. Join us for a practical introduction to the art and science of the archaeology of the self. For more information, see www.manyriversbooks.com or call 707-829-8871. Also coming up on Thursday, April 21st at 7:30 p.m. at Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, Travis Wernett, certified projective dream worker, will offer a presentation entitled Group Dream Work and Sound Healing, Dreams as Sacred Stories as Dreams. Cal's Radio is generously supported by a number of underwriters. We'd like to thank Sonic.net for their generous support. Sonic.net is a full-service internet provider dedicated to delivering fast, reliable, and affordable connectivity with award-winning technical support. For information, call www.sonic.net on the web. Thank you once again for joining us on the Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com. as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments, feedback, and the results of your work of the week to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Please join us again next Saturday. Coming up from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hop. Stay tuned. For now, we'll leave you with That's Just Fine for Me from In the Saddle by Led Ka'apana and Bob Brosman.